Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Scott. Together, we own Stage Left and Capo Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hey, good morning there, Marky.
Hey, Francis. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. I pulled off the AP wire a little while ago, actually, and I was just waiting to get to it until the story was ripe. Dateline Waukesha, Wisconsin. Lance Nesta did what many people do when receiving a fruitcake. He set it aside only to rediscover it later.
At the bottom of his closet?
More than 40 years later in his mother's attic. Nesta...
Yikes.
His quote, "I was amazed it hadn't changed at all."
The question is, did he have the guts to eat it?
Nesta's two aunts sent him the fruitcake in November 1962 while he was stationed in Alaska with the Army. "I opened it up and didn't know what to do with it," Nesta said. "I wasn't going to eat it, and I liked my fellow soldiers, so I wasn't going to share it with them either." At best he can remember, he packed the cake with the rest of his belongings and shipped it home to Waukesha when he left the military a few years later. He recently discovered the boxed fruitcake in the attic of his mother's home in Waukesha. His mom had given him advance warning of the fruitcake back in 62. She knew I hated the damn things, but she said she didn't have the heart to tell my aunts, who had already mailed it. The cake arrived wrapped in brown paper with a red fragile handle with care sticker on it. The cake itself was contained in a round blue tin printed with the words, "Old-fashioned fruitcake. Now it's just old."
Well, Francis, you know what? That cake might have gone bad by now. That article is almost 2 weeks old.
You know, which begs the question, is fruitcake really food? And what was the shipping on that back in 1962? That's great. My favorite quote is, "It hadn't changed." It was in an attic, ladies and gentlemen, for 40 years.
That's really scary stuff. You know, just a few days ago, we were talking about salmon and the benefits of salmon and how it can prevent murder in inmates and all kinds of
crazy. Yeah, if you keep a salmon under your bed and someone comes into your house, you can whack him
in the face with it. No, that's not
how. Why don't you recap that a little bit for
just
me?
How the omega-3s actually are causing inmates to...
In prisons.
To have...
Less violent
behavior. And it's just amazing.
You just said how salmon can be used to prevent murder.
Well, that's the title of the article.
Yeah.
Does eating salmon lower the murder rate?
But you did it out of context, so it sounded like you would wear it under your shirt or something. All right, go ahead.
So anyway, a few people contacted, and the concern, salmon's gotten a little bit of a bad rap lately because of the PCBs, especially in farm-raised salmon, and how much of an issue that's become, and am I doing more harm than good by eating salmon. I just wanted to read a quote from a publication called the Nutrition Action Health Letter. And they don't quote who their experts are, but one of the things that it reads here is, and we know that salmon is a really, really healthy food. One of the things it reads here is, experts estimate that the heart-healthy omega-3 fats in wild or farmed salmon, that's wild or farmed salmon, can save at least 300 lives for every death from cancer caused by the contaminants in salmon. And what they're talking about there is that the omega-3s are so good for your heart and so good for the rest of your body that that more than compensates for the increased PCBs. Now, Francis and I are not going to say to you...
We're in favor of PCBs.
Exactly. Go ahead, dump all the PCBs you want. That salmon's still good for you. But we are going to say that salmon is one of those foods, and there are a lot of fish in this category that are very high in omega-3s and are very, very good for you, and you should really introduce into your diet.
And what Mark is saying is that there are a lot of fish in the sea, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, my goodness gracious. But anyway, one of the other things that this article recommends is that wild salmon is the least likely to be contaminated, which has been pretty well documented through most of the studies, that when they catch a wild fish, it generally has lower PCBs than a farm-raised fish. And then it goes on to say that Atlantic salmon from Chile or Washington or other farm salmon from the U.S., Canada, or Norway are probably cleaner than Scottish or Faroe Island salmon just because of the waters from which they come. But also, look for things like organic farm-raised salmon. Look for that's a real word, and people have been taking that very, very seriously. Farm salmon, and Francis and I have talked about this on past shows, farm salmon can have a lot of contaminants. They can. What ends up happening is they put too many fish in too small an area.
Well, and they're also, I mean, to responsibly run a fish farm, like there's this Scottish Quality Salmon Alliance, SQS, they make sure that their farms are good for the fish and good for the environment. Those are usually practices that are one and the same. You can run, I mean, if you run a fish farm poorly, a fish farm can release into the waters where you're running that fish farm untreated waste, the equivalent of a city of 40,000 people.
That's okay? Pretty amazing.
And that's, I mean, that can do real damage with fish farms. However, when fish farms are responsibly run, and those fish will be a little more expensive, you can have a benign impact on the farm, on the environment, and take some pressure off wild salmon stock. So it's a complicated issue. Mm. And if you go to our website, you will find links to seaweb.org and a couple of places which will help you navigate if you want to sort of buy salmon responsibly or buy fish responsibly for your health as well as buy fish responsibly for the planet. And again, those are usually one and the same. There are resources at your disposal and even little pocket guides you can buy and stick in your wallet.
And with these fish farms, and it's just like land farms, I mean, it's very similar. The earth is renewable. A lot of things will come back as long as we don't abuse them, as long as we don't go over the top, as long as we don't try and do too much in too small an area, something that is unsustainable. And Francis and I use the word sustainable when we talk about agriculture all the time. And sometimes we're talking about fish farming, and sometimes we're talking about farming on land. But when we overdo it, when we go too far, when we push the envelope to see how many fish we can pack in how small an area and what kind of garbage we can feed them in and have them actually survive and then feed it to us, that's when we run into problems.
It seems like a lot of work, and it is some more work to keep aware of what's out there and to eat responsibly. As a restaurateur, because I know we have a lot of restaurateurs who listen to the show, to do that work for your patrons and truthfully be able to present to them that something is good for them and good for the planet on the plate and to have done that research and either name the farm or name where it comes from or name why it's sustainable and it works, your customers will, many of your customers are very happy to have that, are very happy to hear that, and very happy that you've done the work for them because they want to feel good about what mm-hmm. they've eaten. And they're willing often to pay a premium to feel good about what they've eaten. And when they, and if you've done the work for them, that really is a service that you provide to your guests.
Realize in some cases with these salmon fish farms, with what they're feeding the salmon, you're better off feeding them that 44-year-old fruitcake that Francis was talking about earlier.
Well, it gives them a certain rosy hue and a sort of a nutty, fruity quality. We belabor these points a little bit, but the world has changed in such a way where with overnight shipping and with the technology that's available to fishing fleets now, we can fish out stocks of fish in no time. I mean, it took 100 years of irresponsible fishing to fish out the Atlantic cod fishery. We can deplete the Chilean sea bass inside of 5 years if we mm-hmm. want to, and if we're not really responsible, and frankly, if we don't take action to make sure that we don't. And so that's sort of the message of this show, and we're helping to spread some good information out there. And restaurateurs, you have a specific responsibility and a greater responsibility to be knowledgeable about where your food comes from and where your patrons' food comes from. Hey, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Catherine Lombardi and Stage Left Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Katie Sparks. Katie was once chef at a great little restaurant in New York City called Quilty's. Quilty's was a restaurant that started in Princeton, New Jersey, before opening its second and more famous outpost in New York. Mark and I knew the restaurant well, and we were there for the... We didn't know Katie then, but I was there for the grand opening party because we knew the guys from Princeton. And in 1998, she was named one of the best new chefs in America by Food & Wine and a rising star chef by both the Wine Spectator and Restaurant Hospitality magazine. Quilty's didn't survive the post-9/11 crunch downtown, but Katie's still going strong, cooking and writing. Her cookbook, which she co-wrote with Andrea Strong, a one-time guest on the show, is Sparks in the Kitchen, and she joins us today to talk about all that stuff. Hi, Katie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Hi, Katie. So nice to have you with us today.
Well, I'm really pleased to. Thanks.
I have to tell you, the first time I encountered, we met briefly, and because I knew the guys who own Quilties in Manhattan because we had known them, because Princeton is only 20 minutes south of where we are, and we sort of struck up a relationship. And I walked in and I looked at your menu, and I have to tell you, it was one of those times in my life where I was wrong.
Why?
Because I looked at the menu and I said, because your food is, you have your own frame of reference, and at Quilties you really have your own frame of reference. And I looked at the menu and I said, oh, this will never work. And I came into dinner a week later, and along with dinner I ate my words.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that.
Katie, I'd like to tell you, and I can vouch for Francis, he's actually wrong all the time. Don't worry about it at all.
No, I want to be special.
Well, so now that was your first, because we're going to talk about a lot of the interesting things you've done in your book that's out there now that people can pick up, and we're going to link everybody to that book on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. But that was your first, you know, stepping out as an executive chef in New York at a high-profile restaurant. You got a lot of accolades. What was that like, did you have an idea of what you wanted to do with food that was unique and different when you opened
that position? Absolutely. In fact, I have to, you know, I thanked the owners, Jim and Sam and Jason, profusely in the book, because it's very rare to be given that much freedom of expression. Mm-hmm. You know, usually business owners and chefs, I mean, they find an accommodation. I would say we did too, but I mean, I just had so much creative freedom. It was unreal. I was like the envy of my, you know, chef friends. But I had to, because about 2 years before, I'd left working for Bobby Flay and really enjoyed that. I was his executive sous chef at Mesa and then chef de cuisine at Bolo.
The question, though, is what did you do with that freedom? And because, honestly, I read your menu, and why I started that way was I read your menu and I thought, you know, I had never seen anything like that, and it sort of had a little retro feel to it, and I thought, this is totally different. I don't see this working. And then I ate your food, and that was a revelation. But what was different?
I think what's different is I had a lot of courage, because I was in this place, having left this, you know, really successful machinery of Mesa and Bolo, and then had a couple of years of struggling, mm-hmm. where I actually took a step backward and became a line cook for a while. Mm-hmm. And then that's when I realized that it wasn't about my career progression, like becoming a chef and making a chef salary and having control of the kitchen. It was simply that I really, really loved food. And that's why I was able to take that ego hit and that, you know, financial hit and go backwards for a while, because there was a little gap missing. I'd gone, you know, from the Quilted Giraffe, which is a 4-star, you know, French-inspired Asian fusion thing, to Mesa, which is much more high-volume casual. And somehow, I didn't know, I'd lost my way culinarily a mm-hmm. little bit. So I took a step backward. I went and I cooked for Elka Gilmore briefly. And then for some reason, I just, like, found my groove again. I'm like, I know what I want to cook now. It's not going to be Bobby's food. It's not going to be Barry Wine's food. It's not going to be Elka's food.
I'm going to tell you, though, Katie, I think that we all, people who succeed in this business, what you can do is, and what you should do is, you should take something from every experience.
Right.
I'll tell you that one of the most important experiences in my culinary career was at one of the worst restaurants that I ever worked in, because I learned so many of the things ways I didn't want to do things, so many of the results. I got to see the results of things being done the wrong way.
And
I learned a lot from that experience, and I count that experience as important to me as some of the best places I worked in.
Oh, yeah, and I certainly am not saying I didn't take every advantage of everything I'd learned from other chefs. I'm just saying I didn't feel like I needed to. I felt like I could break the mold a little bit.
Well, and you did. But you know what? You know, you said it, you just said something that really struck a note with me. You said, you know, it wasn't about my ego. I took a step back and I took a cut in salary, or I took a cut in prestige, to go and fill in this hole in my culinary vision. And you know, chefs are very ego-driven people, and it takes an exceptional chef to do that. And some of the best chefs we know, David Drake, who's a great chef here in New Jersey, who was executive chef of a place called The Frog and the Peach in New Jersey. It had 3 stars from the New York Times. Do you know him?
No, I've got to get over there. He's
got a great place, but he's got his own place now called Restaurant David Drake. But I remember he was executive chef of The Frog and the Peach. It was 3 stars, and he said, you know, I've got a hole in my education. And he took about 3 years out and went and worked in other people's kitchens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As a pastry chef. Because he had a hole in pastry in his personal repertoire, he went and worked at a pastry chef at some of the
top restaurants.
The only way to
grow, really, the only way to have longevity in this business is to keep educating yourself and be humble. I mean, I think it's a business that really fosters humility because there's so much to know and there's so much talent in the business. And I think you're really making a mistake when you build these barriers around yourself and say, you know, if you start to believe your own press, you're really starting you're in dangerous territory.
Well, you know, that's true, but there are also many people who do. And I think it also, you know, to be humble and at the same time to be strong enough to withstand all the stuff that the business throws at you, there's a reason that egomaniacs thrive in this society, because if you take it personally, you're going to be crying in your kitchen every night.
Right, hey,
listen, when
right.
we come back, we're going to be talking more with Katie Sparks about being a chef and turning that over into being a food writer and a caterer in just a moment. Our guest is Katie Sparks. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and stage left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagat and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Catherine Lombardi and Stage Left Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And our guest today is Katie Sparks. She was named one of the top best new chefs in America by Food and Wine and Rising Star Chef by both the Wine Spectator and Restaurant Hospitality magazine in 1998. Her cookbook is Sparks in the Kitchen. We were talking about, Katie, you said you took a step back, when you were working in a high profile place, and you went back to find your way, and you took a little, you put your ego aside and went back and learned, and then you came out as your own chef, you know, having filled in those holes. And you know, Sam and Jim took a real chance on you,
who were the owners of Quilties at the time.
Yeah.
And you took a real chance on them.
Right.
And you know, the other thing is, I just want to talk about this for a second. You're a chick.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know if you know this or not.
I haven't noticed that.
But I mean, now, and I say that with tongue in cheek, because, you know, being a female executive chef, I mean, there are unique challenges and there are certain barriers that come with that. Can you talk to us about that experience at all?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, one of my strengths as a chef is that I choose the people to work for pretty carefully. And one of the reasons that I think that there was that synergy between Sam and Jim and I is that we had some background in common. I was born in Princeton, New Jersey. My father taught there. My brother and sister attended Princeton. You know, there's like culturally a connection.
Mm-hmm,
and then,
mm-hmm.
You know, and that's so important when you work for people, that there's something that you can relate back to. I mean, we're both, you know, all of us are well-traveled and well-educated, and you speak the same language about food.
You have the same frame of reference.
Yeah, and even though they didn't know my cooking, they just kind of got a good feeling from me, and vice versa. I liked the way they weren't trying to dominate the conversation. It was really sort of like, who are you and how could we make this work kind of attitude, which is just so appealing in anybody.
One of the things I liked about Quilties that I think we try to create in our own restaurants is, and when you really do need to speak the same language, the key people that are running it, because you're trying to create a locus of community.
Yes.
And if you're trying to create the family table, you've got to function as a family to be able to do that.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought about it that way, but that's true.
Anyway, when we come back, we're going to be talking with Katie Sparks, and enough about the past. We're going to talk about her current book and what she's doing today. She's a very exciting chef in America, very exciting cookbook author, and to track your career, Katie, is really interesting look at what it's like to be a culinary professional today. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Katie Sparks is our guest today. Katie is one of the most interesting chefs in America. I think we've been familiar with Katie's cuisine since she opened a restaurant called Quilty's in New York City, which had some New Jersey roots. And she's now written a book called Sparks in the Kitchen. She's working with a catering company, and she's also worked with Balducci's. And, Katie, I want to ask you about the transition. You went from, in 98, you're named by major national publications as one of the top rising chefs in the country. And Quilty's did very well for a number of years. And then it was September 11th really closed Quilty's. And because it was on a great trajectory until September 11th, 2001. Now, you then made a transition. And you made a transition from being the hot, you know, working executive chef in the kitchen every night to a more civilized lifestyle. Can you tell us what you did and how that transition was? Because I think that's on the mind of a lot of culinary professionals as to where their careers are going to go and when it gets sane.
I want to know if that was a hard decision to make.
Yes, it was a hard decision. The way it happened was about a year and a half before we closed the restaurant. Well, no, actually 2 years before the restaurant closed. So this is, 98 or 99, something like that. I knew that, you know, I was in my late 30s, and my husband and I wanted to have a child, and I couldn't justify waiting any longer, you know. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't an owner in the restaurant. I didn't have any real financial security in that way, although, you know, time has told me that I don't know that owning a restaurant is getting more financial security.
I was going to go there.
Time has told me the same thing, Katie. And mine are still open, but I...
Yeah. So I talked to the owners, to Sam and Jim, and I told them that I really wanted to feel stable so that I could continue working at the level I was and also have a child. And they were very happy to say, whatever you need, you know, short of we cannot make you a partner because there's three partners already. It's a small restaurant. We don't want to do that. But what we do want to do is assure you in every way possible, support you in every way possible. And they were completely true to their word. So I went ahead and you know, had my son in 2000, and I went right back to work. You know, I had a husband at the time. I'm now separated from my husband, but at the time he was very supportive in terms of taking up a lot of the childcare and that kind of thing. So it really freed my mind to be in the workplace fully mm-hmm. when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
But when it closed, I really didn't think of doing anything other than just opening my own place. In mm-hmm. fact, I had sort of a bunch of investors and different spaces, and you know, it's harder than it looks from the outside to open a restaurant in New York City. I mean,
but we're on the inside, so we know. But I'll tell you, you know, what's interesting is how the buzz was, because I loved your food and I ate your food. We met a couple times. I went in with a couple of groups, and you cooked for groups of us at a time. We used to belong to a lunch club called the Red Meat Club.
Yeah.
Did you ever hear of the Red Meat Club?
Yes.
You cooked for us once or twice.
That's
but
great.
Here's the deal. By the time we got to you, we were drunk. Because the Red Meat Club would go out to lunch at a steakhouse in Manhattan.
Red Meat Club is a lunch club. If we got to you at dinner, that was never a good sign.
Oh, my goodness.
But you cooked some amazing meals. And we were all chefs and wine buyers and bartenders. And you blew us away every time.
Thank you.
But... And what was great is you would often, because we were restaurant professionals, it was a great courtesy, and I knew Sam and Jim, but you, on a number of occasions, came out and spoke with us about your food, and it was just, I got a great feeling about it, and that's when so we followed you, and every time you were sort of negotiating on a space, we're like, you hear Katie Sparks is going to open a place, and it didn't happen. So we had false starts there a couple times.
And I hated to use the PR that way, but really in reality, in order to get enough money together, you kind of had to. It was mm-hmm. it was unpleasant. It was unpleasant to overpromise and underdeliver for sure. But you know, at that time, post 9/11, there was so little money, and I mean, people weren't committing, and it had an edge of desperation to it for me.
So what made you decide? So what made you decide to abandon the idea of opening a new restaurant?
The economics of it became really ferocious, and I wasn't sure that. You know, I wasn't finding the right space. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was, we were so close a couple of times that I frankly just ran out of money. I mean, I just couldn't hang in there anymore. I had to get back to work.
Before,
because this was full time for me, you know, mm-hmm. finding the space, negotiating with the land. You know, that took so much time.
We know.
Raising money. Yeah, you know, and so it just kind of broke me. And, I had a hard time imagining going back to work for other people, but at the same time, you know, I live in the real world. Mm-hmm. I have mortgage and all that stuff. So what I wanted to do was find something I really wanted to do.
So before we go into what you're doing now, which are some pretty interesting things, I think, is there a future for Katie Sparks' restaurant? Will Katie Sparks ever try and go and do
yes.
that again?
Katie Sparks has been so... I know so much now that I know what it's going to take for me to be successful in every way that I want to be. I want to do great food. I want it to be this community feeling like Quilty's had. I want it to be profitable. And that's just going to take time.
Mm-hmm. Very hard to mix family life with that. I should warn you as the guy
yes.
with four kids.
Yes.
So when you make the transition, and actually, you know what, before we go into the transition, I want to touch on that with the two of you guys, because I don't have a family. I don't have a girlfriend. I don't have a plant.
You got me, Francis.
Oh, lucky man.
Heaven help me. But it's hard. I mean, I've had relationships in the past, and obviously I have no kids, but it must be very hard. I think that one of the hard things about the restaurant business is, even if you do get some time off, it's usually not evenings. And how do you manage? And you did it for a while, Katie. How do you manage having a kid at home, having a family life you're trying to keep together, and having to be in the restaurant most evenings? Even if you get 2 days a week off, most people, even if they work 5 days a week, they're home by 6 or 7 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
How did you make family life and being a chef in a restaurant work?
Well, you know, I have to say, it was so early in my son's life. He was a year and a half
yep.
old when we closed. So at that point, whenever you're with them, it doesn't matter. He's not in school. So
right.
I was going to the restaurant at 11 in the morning or noon. I had those great morning hours with him when kids are really kind of at their best anyway. So that was great, and I felt good about that.
Yeah, I've definitely had the same experience with the kids.
Yeah,
when they're young, it's easy.
When they get older, it's harder because now he's in school, and... It's funny because I think had the right restaurant come along, I would have done it, and I would be now wondering, did I make the right decision? Because I never see my son. You know, that could be my life right now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the conundrum I think that all restaurant people face. You know, and if you can, and a lot of people who work part time as bartenders or part time as waiters, they stay in a place for a long time. You get seniority, you get the best shifts, and you try and do it in 3 nights a week or 4 nights a week, so you have those other nights off. But
yeah.
the chef's there every night. Or five
that's,
nights a week.
The chef doesn't have to be, though, and I think that's a common misperception. Mm-hmm. I mean, I never felt like a workaholic as a chef. I feel like I've always wanted to balance my personal life with my working life.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked 5 days a week, which is not crazy at all. I did work at night, but there were nights that I took off if there was something I wanted to do or, you know, see a play or something. The issue is how do you inspire people around you to cook at that same level whether you're there or not.
And how do you?
The way that I personally do it is I'm extremely engaged with my cooks. I mean, it's just a constant communication and expression of enjoyment and joy and being part of their lives and making sure that they feel taken care of if they ever need a night off. Like, for example, I kind of made an informal pact with my sous chef, which was I will never call you in on your days off unless, I mean, I will work 3 stations if I have to.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to call you. I'm just going to suck it up, and I'm going to make it happen. I'm going to, because I know you need that refreshing, you know, every
sure.
week. You need to be able to commit to your life.
Yeah, a lot of restaurants work in the city, and Francis and I believe, like you do, that 5 days a week, you need to have 2 days off a week in order to recharge. But a lot of restaurants, it's 6 days a week, 70, 75 hours a week. That's the norm.
And I think that's, they design into that system the burnout. They use very inexperienced young people.
Mm-hmm.
They tell them that, you know, this is a learning experience. I'm not going to pay you, but you're going to learn a lot. And that sometimes is true, and sometimes it's just, you know, not true. It's just a sort of a lure to get them in there. I was lucky when I did my crazy hours, like at the Quilted Giraffe and everything. I was really learning. It was a small, intimate kitchen. It wasn't, you know, turn and burn kind of 4-star experience.
Well, now people can learn a lot about what you learned from buying your wonderful book. It's a cookbook, but it's more than a cookbook. It's kind of a chatty cookbook that I really enjoyed called Sparks in the Kitchen. When we come back from the break, we're going to be talking more with Katie Sparks about that book, Sparks in the Kitchen, and about her experience making in her words, I'll put down as vivid and honest food and how you can too. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Catherine Lombardi at Stage Left Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Having a lovely time today talking with Katie Sparks. Katie was a chef at a restaurant in New York many years ago that we ate at often called Quilty's. Her book is that you can find now at restaurantguysradio.com. You can go there and we'll link you to the book so you can buy it. It's called Sparks in the Kitchen, and you wrote this book with Andrea Strong as your co-author. What made you decide to write a book?
Well, you know, I really credit Andrea with it. I'd been approached before from food writers and flirted with people like Peter Kaminsky, and, you know, that was fabulous, and other food writers had approached me. But really, I wasn't feeling, at the time I was a working chef, and I thought, unless this writer takes a tremendous amount off my hands, I'm not going to be able to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So when Andrea and I started talking about it, I was between gigs again. And, you know, she's just a make-it-happen kind of person.
Yes.
You've spoken with her. She's really
intense. I will tell you, and you can pass this compliment along, and Andrea, if you're listening, you can take this as a great compliment. I say the same thing about my very strong sisters. I wouldn't get in her way. That's what I would say about Andrea Strong.
And I imagine that people thought, what a weird combination, you know, Katie Sparks and Andrea Strong, because temperamentally we're pretty different.
But it's great.
But, it worked out really well, because it allowed me to write in my voice, all my experiences, and then I'd pass it on to Andrea, and she'd say, I'm not going to touch this. This is great.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just be the, you know, the reader. So
mm-hmm.
What do you mean here, or why is that important? So she really helped me communicate, but I was able to write, you know, the essay parts that was written by me. And then when we came to the recipes, she was so pivotal because I might take a leap of faith that people understood what I was talking about, and she'd be like, no, you need to explain this.
Yeah, yeah, that's kind of like a chef speak.
People don't realize that when people in the restaurant business write each other recipes, if you go and look at a chef's recipe that he's written down for the other chefs to follow, the cooks to follow, you
that's
as a home cook are going to say, oh, what's that mean? You know, you're like, oh, that means, you know, there's 20 pages of what is assumed that you know.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
oh, my God, trying to write it down. And our editor is Judith Jones, who was Julia Child's editor. She's extremely exacting. She doesn't let you get away with anything. So it was rigorous. That's what I like.
Is there an overarching theme to the book? Is there something that you wanted to communicate besides just a collection of recipes?
Yes, the overarching theme is really the joy that I take from cooking, the joy that I take in sharing this love that I'm just very, very blessed to have. It's wonderful when you can find something in your life to do as a career that it just turns you on every day. I mean, I know how lucky I am, and that's what I'm trying to share. It's like, let's get people back in the kitchen because it's fun. It shouldn't be a chore. You shouldn't feel. And so when I was writing, I was trying to help you, like, stay with me here, you know, or
uh-huh.
I'll stay with you. I mean, the tone of the writing in the body of the recipe, not just in the header, but as we're cooking together, I'm trying to encourage you. You know, this is a little tricky, but if you pay attention here, or you turn your flame down, or you make sure that you're, you know, whatever that little tip is, there's lots of chef tips and tricks and seasonal variations. It's all meant to make it easy and fun without being simple-minded. You know, I'm not like that 30-second chef, you know?
Yes, we understand.
We got that. That's clear. You're not going to take the cheese whiz and put it with the liverwurst on a Ritz cracker?
You know, somewhere along the road, people lost their love of being in the kitchen. I think maybe it's because we're all so busy. But people lost their love of being in the kitchen, and I love the way your book conveys that that exact love for being in the kitchen.
You can love even something as simple as, like, I sometimes look at one of these wooden spoons that I have, and that's made out of olive wood, and I bought it in Italy, and I just love it. You know, it just makes me happy just to look at this object, or, you know, a knife that my friend brought back from Japan when he was over that just was handmade in a small town by the one, you know, knifesmith, and it's just, I think you want to ritualize the whole experience, and it makes me sad when I see these incredible gourmet chef kitchens that everyone's building that nobody uses. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I think what Mark and I are drawn to is that cooking brings people together, and it also brings you together with a tradition of cooking, which is why, you know, I'm hopefully this summer going to go to Ferran Adrià's place in Barcelona, you know, Il Bulli, which is this hot place where they're doing all sorts of experimental food. And I need to do that precisely once in my life. But as far as eating food that comes from a tradition, that is life.
Yes.
You know? Your book is very chatty. Chatty Cathy is exactly what I was thinking. And I thought, no, I can't go there, but you can. It's populated with, you know, this sort of contextualizing the food and your own context of the food. I mean, there are pictures of, like, your dad holding a fish that he caught or your mom shopping in a market in Germany. How much of this comes from your family and your history?
Oh, I would say huge, huge amount. I mean, I'm the third in line in kids out of three, and I'm the one who never wanted to leave my mother's kitchen. I was like, they had to leave the country. Literally, my parents left the country for 2 years so that I would go to college. it wasn't their main reason, but that's what happened. So, you know, and then I went to Middlebury College, which was not a stretch because that's where my father taught, but it was a very good school, but I found myself getting really depressed by eating in the food halls and stuff. So even though I wasn't a French major, I went to the chateau, as we called it, and there they had the rituals of the table, even though it was still the dining hall for the students.
Mm-hmm.
They would have cloth napkins because it was France, you know. They
made
a mini France there. And I also lured my, every night around 9 o'clock, I would lure my poor roommates downtown to Middlebury and say, we just got to go to a restaurant and sit there and just be served and have a cup of coffee. I'll pay for it, but I need to be somewhere where people want to be around a table. It drives me crazy.
When we come back, we're going to talk about how Mark and I met in college in a very similar sort of a feeling at a Rutgers University dormitory in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hey, our guest is Katie Sparks. Her book is Sparks in the Kitchen. You should stay tuned, but even if you're not, go to the website, and you can restaurantguysradio.com and buy Sparks in the Kitchen. It's a great book to have on your table. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Catherine Lombardi and Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest is Katie Sparks. Her book is Sparks in the Kitchen, and she's sparking up our radio show right now. Sorry I couldn't help with the pun there.
Oh, golly.
Yeah, it's weak. I only got 3 minutes left in the show.
I apologize to Katie while she's still on the air.
And our listening audience. You were talking about in college. You went to college, and you sort of were horrified by the dining hall. We had a similar experience.
Well, Katie, you were saying you got to go to the French dining hall. We went to Rutgers, and our choices were Tillett or Brower Commons, and really the steakums were pretty much the same no matter where you went.
And the cheese whiz fries were also the same, and that was the highlight. Well, we met actually in college. I transferred into Rutgers sophomore year, and I was working as a supermarket manager, and it wasn't the best, but I was a closing manager, so at midnight, they would take the bread that they had baked that day, which was sort of middling, but better than anything we were getting on campus, and we could buy it for a dime. And we also got a discount on cheese. So I would come home at about 1 in the morning after working a full shift at work and being in class all day, and Mark would have been in class for an hour and then drinking all night. And and I came in around midnight with two loaves of bread under my arm and a hunk of provolone.
Well, I'm sorry. Mark was the first couple of weeks he came home with one loaf of bread and a hunk of provolone on his arm. Second couple of weeks.
And Mark, who was sort of friendly anyway, but he was like the king of the dorm. You walk in with a provolone and the bread, and he's like, hey, who's the new kid? Let's invite him. And that was how it began.
I got beer in my fridge. Molson Golden, I think it was.
He had the beer, and I had the provolone. Anyway, Katie, so your book is out. When did it come out?
It came out in January.
And you're having great success with it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm working hard on a second proposal. I think, you know, I love it. I love writing. I love communicating with people, you know, in the written way as well as with food on the plate. So it's really exciting.
Well, we have 37 questions that we didn't get to ask you that we had all written down. And so I'm wondering if you'll come back on the show sometime in the future.
I would love to.
Great.
Real pleasure.
You
Great.
Are the best. Thanks, Katie.
Well, thank you, Mark. Thank you, Francis.
All right, take care. That was Katie Sparks. She cooked some great food for us, and her book, which we read only recently, because we were having her on the show and had to read the book, is wonderful. And it's not just a cookbook. It's a good read. It's a good thing to, like, sit down and read, like A Measure of Grace and those other books that we've recommended. It's not just a collection of recipes.
And she's working for a very interesting organization now called Great Performances that hires a lot of actors and the like. And I want to get her back and talk about this.
And
things.
The engineer's waving at me. That's for the next show, evidently. I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. This is Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.